Okay. So, I guess we can start. And again, it's really strange to sit here in the big Dhamma hall at the Maloka Center. It's empty. There's no one here at all, except for myself and my venerable friend over here, a venerable Vimutto, and one volunteer to run the live streaming thing. So that's kind of strange, but hopefully there will be a few out there who are listening, and it will be certainly be recorded, so it will be available for people later on as well. So I'm going to have a look at the Brahma Jala Sutta, and this sutta is the first sutta of the Digha Nikaya. Digha means long, the long discourses of the Buddha. We've had one session on the sutta before. We had looked at the kind of introductory parts of that sutta, and now we're just going to carry on from that introductory part. And the idea, the interesting thing about this sutta is that it is really about the idea of right view or right understanding in Buddhism, and this is one of the reasons why it is likely to be the first sutta of the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses, because it is about kind of setting the scene, the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, getting everything ready so that the rest of the path can be practiced from that. So this is probably one reason why it is the first sutta of the Digha Nikaya. Although in some other traditions it is not the first sutta of their Digha Nikaya, so there is some disagreement about that. So the idea here, the sutta starts out, as we saw last time, with some people criticizing and praising the Buddha, one person criticizing, one person praising, and then the Buddha starts this discourse, and he talks about why the Buddha really is worthy of praise, what are the qualities. And he starts off by enumerating all the reasons why he is not worthy of praise, and those reasons are issues of morality. Morality is not enough to make the Buddha worthy of praise. And then he moves on to the idea of right view later on. This is what makes the Buddha special, because that right view is really the insight into the nature of reality that gives rise to that right view. So that right view is essentially equivalent to dependent origination and seeing non-self and all of these kind of things. So that's why it is so profound. So it's right view that makes the Buddha special. And based on that right view, he's able to distinguish between all the various views in the world. Different views that different religions have, or different cults, sects have. And then he kind of understands the distinction between all these views and which ones are valid, etc., and which ones are useful. So that's the background. So what we have looked at so far is we have looked started looking at what is the shorter section on virtue, we are, I don't know if those of you who have access to this in Maurice Walsh's translation, it is paragraph 110, 1.10 paragraph that we are up to, and we have had a look at all the factors of right speech. That was where we stopped last time, and now we're going to continue from there. So we have had a look at all the usual ideas of morality, right action and right speech, and now we come to some more details about morality on the Buddhist path. So we'll talk about that in a second in a bit more detail. So this is how it goes in the English translation. This is Bhantasujato's translation that I've been using here. So it's going to be a little bit different from the one found Maurice Walsh's translation that you find in the usual translation that is often used. So the sutta goes on. It says, the ascetic Gotama refrains from injuring plants and seeds. He eats in one part of the day, abstaining from eating at night and food at the wrong time. He refrains from dancing, singing, music, and seeing shows. He refrains from beautifying and adorning himself with garlands, perfumes, and makeup. He refrains from high and luxurious beds. He refrains from receiving gold and money. So I'll stop there. because those factors there are essentially equivalent to the the remaining of the 10 precepts. We've seen most of the other precepts already. These are the remaining ones. But especially, and these are, and the interesting thing about these precepts is that they are slightly different from the earlier ones are moral precepts in the sense that you're literally creating bad karma and it's immoral to break them, whereas these particular precepts are more about renunciation. So here we're starting to see the path of renouncing. And this is the distinction between the 5 precepts and the 8 precepts, is that the 8 precepts are much more connected with the idea of renouncing things. So there's some other things you are renouncing here. The first one is kind of interesting. You refrain from injuring plants and seeds, Bijagama, Bhutagama in Pali. And the question is it what is this? Is this an act of morality, or is it immoral to injure plants or seed, or is it an act of renunciation? What exactly is it? It seems to be, the point here is that these are other people who are praising the Buddha for this kind of conduct. So it seems that this was a kind of expected conduct in ancient India. And if you read the rules of the monastics that you find in the Vinaya Pitaka, the codes of rules and actions and how the Sangha is supposed to live together, if you look at that, one of the rules laid down by the Buddha is exactly this. As monastics, you should not injure plants or cut down trees and that kind of stuff. And the reason the Buddha gives there is because people in India regarded plant life as a one-facultied life. In other words, they had the faculty of touch, so they could feel it if you injured it. And this was the reason behind laying down that rule. So as with many rules in the Vinaya, it is the lay people who were complaining about the monks, because the monks were considered to do something that was not acceptable. And this seems to have been one of the norms in ancient Indian society, not necessarily anything to do with morality as such, but one of these ancient norms. And if you transgress those norms, that was considered bad. It doesn't seem that from a Buddhism it is immoral to do this, but it was considered bad nonetheless from that kind of society. And that's why, as a monastic, you're not supposed to do it. So that is kind of interesting. So what do you do in the present day? How seriously do you take these rules, if they really are ancient Indian ideas about how to live properly? How seriously do you take it? And we tend to follow these ancient rules as monastics at Bodhinyana Monastery, simply because they are rules. And even though it looks like it has to do with the kind of ancient Indian society, you never can ever be 100% sure. Sometimes you kind of just follow these rules because they are there, because this is what the Buddha laid down. Another reason to follow them is that often you get criticized, severely so, if you don't follow the Patimokkha rules, even if they may not have any moral or real value in modern society. People will criticize. Sometimes it's easier just to follow them simply because they are there. They're part of the Patimokkha of monastics. So this is usually how we do things at Bodhinyana Monastery, and almost all serious practitioners, monastic practitioners around the world will tend to follow these kind of rules, even though it is not entirely clear how necessary they are for purity in morality. But we don't interpret it in the strictest possible fashion. We are there are allowances in the Vinaya, for example, for destroying plant life, or for doing counter fires, for example, if there's a fire going on. And so this idea is that it's okay to destroy plant life if there is a serious problem like that, especially for fire purposes. So we take these things into account. We try to interpret these kind of rules in a reasonable way, simply because they are not really core aspects of what is morality in Buddhism. Anyway, enough about injuring plants and seeds. Then we have the next one, which is that he eats in one part of the day, abstaining from eating at night and food at the wrong time. And the Pali word for that is eka bhattiko. And eka means one, bhatta is meal. And so it's like a one mealer, someone who eats one meal a day. So the there's a bit ambiguous here whether it means someone who eats in one part of the day or whether it means someone who eats one meal a day here. Eka bhattika could mean both. And Bhantasajjato here translates as eats in one part of the day here. But it could be translated as one who eats one meal per day as well. And so the reason why he translates in this way is because the rule as it is laid down in the Patimokkha for the monastics actually refers to eating in one part of the day. But it seems more likely that the word as it is found here in this sutta actually means eating one meal a day, a single meal a day. So it is not entirely clear. It may be that the ideal is higher, that you should only have one meal a day is the ideal, but that in practice the bar is lowered a little bit so you can eat in one part of the day. So maybe a little bit of distinction there between the two. But it is fairly common among monastics around the world, reasonably, maybe not common, but among some forest monastics at least, it is to eat one meal a day is considered one of the ascetic practices, the dutangas that you find, especially in the Visuddhimagga, but also mentioned occasionally in the suttas as well. So that is the idea of one meal a day, and of course that time of the day that you're supposed to have it is between dawn and solar noon. So solar noon means when the sun reaches the zenith, that's when you're supposed to have your meal before that, if you practice properly. So that is the standard from the suttas. Between dawn, or maybe not even dawn, maybe from when you have the first light in the sky, something like that, until solar noon. Then you abstain from dancing, singing, music, and seeing shows. And the question here is sometimes rises, does this mean that you refrain from seeing these things? In other words, watching it or listening to it? Or does it mean that you shouldn't do these things yourself? And I would say that it means both. It can't possibly mean that you shouldn't be watching dancing, but you are allowed to dance yourself. That would be a bit strange. But I never heard of anyone who interprets it in that way. Yeah. So if you see a monastic who's dancing, then maybe they have missed this particular rule, or they have misinterpreted or whatever. Yeah. Hopefully you won't see too many of those monastics, because probably look a bit strange. These robes are not really suited for dancing. So anyway. So that is that one there, so you can see here, now we are really coming into the idea of restraint. Yeah, the first one about eating one meal a day, now about not seeing or taking part in entertainment. This is about restraint. It's about finding happiness in the world away from the sensual pleasure. That is what this really is all about. So you're moving towards finding happiness through your practice rather than sensuality. That's the purpose of keeping these precepts. And then you have refraining from beautifying and adorning yourself with garlands, perfumes, and makeup. So you shouldn't be too concerned about what you look like. And that is a very much part of the sensual world as well, worrying about what you look like. So you put that to one side. And again, you focus on the mind. You focus on the deeper pleasures of the world. You refrain from high and luxurious beds. And this is a similar kind of thing. And you sleep comfortably, and it's important that all of these things are about the middle way. Yeah, especially the eating and the beds are about the middle way. When you refrain from a high and luxurious bed, it doesn't mean that you kind of sleep in a painful place or you torture yourself, because that doesn't work either. The idea is to find that middle way where the body is comfortable without indulging it. That's the idea throughout all of this. And it's very interesting, the Buddha always gives dispensation from rules, or he gives kind of exception clauses to the rules for the monastics. If they are sick, for example, or if things are too uncomfortable, then he kind of brings things back to a more middle way with things. He doesn't overdo this. The idea of sickness in the suttas is called gilana, and the word gilana is used to mean that someone is not comfortable, is one of the meanings of that. So sickness can be very broad, a broad idea in the suttas. So being comfortable is not only recommended, it's not only kind of nice or pleasant is actually recommended in the suttas, that you're comfortable. You should find that middle way here, because that's when your interest in the world disappears. Too much indulgence or too much discomfort, both of those things means that you are somehow involved with that world, either through pleasure or pain. By letting go of that, that's where you find the middle way here. So this is all about renunciation. And so in other words, the point here is that the Buddha should not really be praised for these things either, yeah? These things are still superficial, that they're not really profound things. And anyone who really has enough, perseverance or commitment is able to live these things, even if they don't have a more profound insight into things. And then the same thing with beautifying yourself, being worried about what you look like, and then the beds and all of that. So all of this about the same thing here. So that kind of rounds up the 10 precepts. Actually, not really. I haven't mentioned the last one, which is he refrains from receiving or accepting gold and money. Yeah, and this is one of the rules that is often flaunted in modern monasticism. If you travel around the world, the vast majority of monastics actually do receive money. It's very, very common, and very often, because they don't know better, this is how they were trained, so they don't really know what is going on. They haven't really thought about the rules properly, or they think that, well, you know, in the present day you have to have this, you can't live without it, and all these kind of things. But there's actually quite a few places in the suttas, or at least two or three places in the suttas, where the Buddha in quite strong terms says that the use of money and any other kind of things similar to money, valuables or whatever kind, uses strong vocabulary to say that this should not be done by monastics. Surprisingly so. Yeah, in one place he says that a monastic who uses money does not shine, loses that power, I suppose, of meditation. Shining here, of course, often refers to the idea of the mind being bright, and of course that also shows usually on the countenance and what you look like externally as well. Your eyes are bright, and all of these things come from that. So you're not bright, you don't shine if you use money. Why? Because, well, if you use money, you're in a sense also, usually it means that you're indulging in the pleasures of the world, because money gives you access to the pleasures of the world. And if you indulge in the pleasures of the world, well, then you are destroying some of your ability to attain deep meditation, because these are contradictory. One goes out, the other one goes in, and you can't do both simultaneously here. So this is why this is an important precept for the monastics. For anyone who is really serious about the path, it matters. Of course, I'm not suggesting that we should judge all people, all monastics who use money in a negative way, and just saying they are bad or whatever. That's not really what I'm suggesting either. Sometimes you may find monastics who use money a little bit, just occasionally, in a good way, and not really overdoing it, and they might even get some really profound meditation because they are wise about how they use it. So I'm just saying this as a general problem, not as a kind of absolute, you know, judgment, pass judgment on people, because there are so many nuances in how these things are done. And occasionally you do meet monastics who use money wisely, and it turns out that sometimes they have very profound meditation at the same time. So it's not these things are not absolutely exclusive if you do it in the right way. But it is an important part of the path. And for that reason, I think it's important that both lay people and other monastics, we have a duty to at least occasionally kind of hint that this is the proper practice for monastics. Okay, so that rounds up the 10 precepts. These are the 10 precepts of a samanera, a novice monk, before you become fully ordained. And if you take away the gold and money, then you are left with the 8 precepts of the 8 preceptors that go on retreat. Yeah, when you go on a retreat and you keep 8 precepts, that is what you keep, those previous ones there. So you notice I removed one precept, was 10. I had 10 precepts, I took away one, and 10 minus 1, I said, was 8. So maybe it's because I didn't go to school or something when I was young, maybe I kind of got that wrong, but the reason is because one of the precepts is divided. Yeah, it's put to it, what, two in the 10 precepts, you find that 2 of those 10 precepts are put together into 1. And that's how you get 8 instead of 9 when you take away gold and money. So, 10 minus 1 is 9, not 8. So I know that, actually. Yeah. But so it's just, I'm just pointing out, it's one of the strange idiosyncrasies of the suttas, that it goes from 8 to 9, but actually there's only 1 precept that is different. Okay, then we have all of these minor things that come in addition to that. And this really just expands on the idea of renunciation. So you refrain from receiving raw grain, raw meat, women and girls, male and female bond servants or slaves, if you like, goats and sheep, chickens and pigs, elephants, cows, horses and mares, and fields and land. And I'll stop there. So all of those things that you have there, these are really things that are signs of wealth in ancient India. Your wealth is often determined, not so much necessarily in terms of gold and money. In the very early days, gold and money was quite rare when the Buddha started out. They didn't really have stamped money as we have in the present day, you know, money with a mark on it and all that. And wealth was very often measured in terms instead of cattle, especially how much cattle you had. And if you had lots of cattle, that was your wealth. That was the ancient Brahmin tradition, pre-Buddhism, that the Brahmins would count their wealth in terms of the cattle that they had. All of these things here then are about wealth, really. And of course, your wealth should be given up usually before you become a monastic. It specifically says in the gradual training, as you find it in the middling sayings, number 27, for example, that you give up a small or large amount of wealth, or a small or large, and also your relatives, and then you go forth and become a monastic as a consequence. So this also is just adding to the idea of renunciation. The previous rule was about not receiving gold and money, but not only do you just not receive it, you also give up your wealth as well. So the whole thing is kind of given up. Here it's about receiving, but actually it's also implied in the gradual training that you give up what you have already. So that is what that is about. It fits in quite nicely with what we have seen before. And now we come to the last section of this part. And it says that you refrain from running errands and messages, buying and selling, falsifying weights, metals and measures, bribery, fraud, cheating and duplicity, mutilation, murder, abduction, banditry, plunder and violence. So if you are a monk, you can't do any of those things. Okay, that kind of makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah, you don't usually expect monastics to get into abductions and mutilation and plunder. Anyway, so it's a little bit strange that this is in there, because it's just bleeding obvious that you shouldn't do this as a monastic. You almost wonder why it is there. It's, you know, it's kind of the basics of the entire monastic life, or is actually based around these things. And it is interesting, because this particular sequence of things that we have seen now, all of these ideas of morality, they are also found in other suttas. And one of those suttas is the sutta I was just mentioning before, Majjhima Nikaya 27, which is the shorter sutta on the simile of the elephant's footprint, the Chulahati Padopama Sutta, in the middle-length sayings of the Buddha 27. And the same sequence is there. Yeah, and that sutta has a number of parallels, or one main parallel in Chinese translation. And what is fascinating is that a Chinese translation is pretty much exactly the same, except that it doesn't have this very last paragraph here, yeah? Refraining from running errands all the way down to violence and plunder. That is missing in that Chinese translation here. And I must admit, I think it is quite likely that this has been added here to the a Pali version because it doesn't really make all that much sense. Yeah, we have already talked about before about the precept of not killing and not stealing, for example. And all of this is just kind of, in a sense, expansion on the idea of not killing and stealing and injuring people. Talked even about, I think, compassion up here, how you're supposed to be compassionate to people. That is also, yeah, that's also up there, a bit further up. And so all of this is just doesn't really fit very well. It's not really required. And it has a more, maybe perhaps, of a commentarial nature. Perhaps originally it was a commentary on how you're supposed to live, or how or the details of not killing and stealing and all of that. But it doesn't really, a lot of it seems very strange. Running errands and messages and buying and selling, perhaps not so much, but you can see why that too would go against the idea of monasticism if you don't have any gold and money. Running errands and messages, basically what that means is that you have a wrong kind of livelihood, and you know, people say, oh, I will give you some food if you take this message from person A to person B or whatever, something like that. So you are kind of living your livelihood, you are doing work in a sense for people in the return for some kind of livelihood. So interesting that it isn't there in the Chinese. So I must admit personally, I suspect that the Chinese version is more likely to be correct in this particular case. Of course, what is interesting, again, is that when you do see differences between the Pali and some of the other versions of the sutta, it's very minor. Yeah, whether that passage is in there or not doesn't really change our understanding of Buddhism, because it's just expanding on something that is there before. So sometimes, you know, we talk about understanding the differences between the suttas, but the result of that kind of inquiry is often very slight. There isn't really, it doesn't make that much difference. Take it out or leave it in. Okay. But what it does, it kind of maybe streamlines the sutta a bit more, and it gives an insight into how the suttas may have evolved a little bit over time. And occasionally it may make a difference. Yeah, occasionally there are things in there which kind of you may wonder, what does that mean? And there are some very good examples of that. There is one sutta in the numerical discourses which looks like it has come from the Jain tradition, because it doesn't really have a Buddhist content at all. It's about how to make an end of karma. And of course, that's not really a Buddhist idea, to make an end of karma. You stop making karma, but you don't make an end of the karmic results. Yeah, that's not the Buddhist idea. And that seems to have come from the Jaina tradition, and it has been pointed out by scholars that actually when you look at the, again, through comparative study, it doesn't it really seem to fit in there at all. And these things, sometimes they are very important, because sometimes some of these suttas are actually used in, even in large Buddhist organizations to show how you're supposed to practice the Dhamma, especially this idea of making an end of all karma, not experiencing any results, burning up your karma so that there's no more karma to be burnt up. That is sometimes something you hear in Buddhist circles, and some very large Buddhist institutions that actually use this kind of idea. So it can matter. It can actually be quite important. In this case, I don't think it does, but occasionally it may matter, and that's when it can be useful. So the old idea of using those passages in the sutta that are you find again and again and again, that are found everywhere, is a very wise advice, because they tend to be very reliable, precisely because they occur so many times. They're very stable. You know, the Buddha would have taught them in many different contexts, and so they are very reliable in that sense. And then the Buddha says, such is an ordinary person's praise of the realized one, the Tathagata, in other words, the Buddha. This is how they praise him, by praising all of this morality. Although from the Buddha's point of view, this is just small stuff. Of course, it's important. The fact that it is minor stuff doesn't mean that it is not important. It is very important, because otherwise it's not going to make any progress at all. But it is also very preliminary here. It's just the starting point of the Buddha's path. It is what gives you access to meditation. And then, of course, that meditation down the line gives you access to insight and wisdom. So it matters. It's just that it is not the core thing of what Buddhism is about. This is why why the Buddha puts it in this way here. So, there you are. Now, comes, it says then this, the shorter section on ethics is finished. Next up comes the middle section on ethics, and then we have the longer section on ethics even further down, one section after the other. So let us let me just start by reading out a little bit of this middle section on ethics, and we can discuss it in a second. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in injuring plants and seeds. These include plants propagated from roots, propagated from stems, propagated from cuttings, propagated from joints, and those from regular seeds as the fifth. The ascetic Gotama refrains from such injury to plants and seeds. Such is an ordinary person's praise of the realized one. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in storing up goods for their own use. These include things such as food, drink, clothes, vehicles, bedding, fragrances, and material possessions. The ascetic Gotama refrains from storing up such goods. Such is an ordinary person's praise of the realized one. And then it goes on, the next one, it goes on to talk about seeing shows, and it gives a large number of shows. I'll read it out in a second. Then comes the one about playing games, all kinds of games, it gives a large number of games. Then it talks about beddings, and it gives a large variety of different kinds of beds and bedding that you use, and are not supposed to use. Then it talks about cosmetics, makeup and garlands and that kind of stuff, and how you're supposed to not do those things. And as you go through this list, one of the things that is quite obvious is that most of these topics in the middle sayings, in the middle sila here, each one of those topics is closely related to the topics that we saw before in the shorter section on morality. So the middle section on morality here seems essentially just to be an expansion on the things that we have already seen before. So instead of just, being satisfied with saying you shouldn't kill plants and seeds, it gives a list of various kinds of seeds and plants. Instead of saying you should only eat once a day, it starts at about not storing food and all kind of other things. Instead of talking just about not seeing shows, it gives a large number of shows you're not supposed to look at, etc., etc., etc. So it is kind of strange why suddenly this great, detailing of those previous precepts that we have seen already. What is the point of that detailing of those precepts? This is what we're seeing here is typically what you will see in the commentaries. The commentaries will often take a particular word found in the suttas, and it will discuss it from all different angles and sides, and then it will show you the various aspects of that particular word. What does it mean to, to beautify yourself? And it gives the various kinds of cosmetics even sometimes and all this kind of stuff. So it details things out. This is can be useful, especially in ancient society. People may have been not clear about what was meant, but it also has its limitations. And one of the problems with that kind of detailing things too much is that it tends to get stuck in a certain time and place, because those details will tend to refer to a particular society at a particular time. In our present society, the kind of entertainment we have, PlayStation and Xbox, that also is included in this here, obviously, but it's not in the list, because the Buddha doesn't. If the Buddha had talked about Xbox and PlayStation, then people wouldn't have understood her. And this is the problem. I'm not even sure how you say Xbox in Pali. Is that Pali word for Xbox? I'm not going to try that one. I'm sure they can kind of come up with an Xbox in Pali. But still, it doesn't really make any sense. So this is why this kind of expansion of things that we have find in the commentaries actually, from a modern point of view, is not necessarily very useful, because what we need to do, we need to go back to the original rule and read the spirit of the rule and understand the rule, what it actually is saying to us, and then apply it for a modern context rather than applying it for a context that is very different from ours. So this is why the commentaries have limitations, whereas the suttas and the stories are often much more broad in the way they define things. They define things that is applicable far more broadly across different societies and across different times. So what is fascinating then about this is that this particular sutta has been studied by Venerable Anālaya in quite a bit of detail. And he has pointed out that in the parallel versions of the sutta, this middle length section, this middle section on ethics does not occur in those parallel versions, nor does a long section on ethics occur. Yeah? So what seems to have happened is that what was originally a commentary on the short section of ethics at some point made its way and became part of the sutta in the Pali, but did not become part of the sutta in that was translated into Chinese. That probably is a Dharmaguptaka version of the sutta. Actually, there's a few versions of the sutta in various types, but in some of those versions it doesn't exist. I can't remember. Probably Sarvastivadin and Mula Sarvastivadin version here. So this is interesting, yeah, how it looks like the commentarial aspect has made its way into the Pali Sutta, not found in the other ones. This, it turns out, is not that uncommon in the suttas for commentarial material to make its way into the suttas and somehow become part of the sutta. And the reason for that, when you know the oral tradition of Buddhism, it is quite obvious how this happens and why it happens. And the reason, of course, is that when a sutta is recited by the monastics, then the commentarial material will often be recited in parallel with the sutta, either before or at the same time, either just after the sutta or at the same time. And sometimes your memory will get confused, and you wouldn't really be able to distinguish between the sutta and the commentary anymore. It's kind of natural, yeah. It would be very surprising if that didn't happen occasionally. And it's surprisingly rare, how rarely found, if you do this comparative studies. But the fact that it's found occasionally should not really be all that surprising to us. That seems to be what is going on here, that this middle section and the long section of morality probably came from the commentaries and somehow made its way into this particular sutta. There's quite a bit of more evidence as well that can be put forward to show that this is likely to have happened. You have to read those comparative studies to see all that evidence that is there. So you may wonder, well, does this matter? Does that mean that suttas are untrustworthy, or does it matter for our understanding of the Dhamma? And as you can see here, it matters probably nothing at all, yeah, because this is just an expansion in terms of what morality has already been talked about. It is giving more specifics. It doesn't really detract from the meaning. So it's not all that important, but the problem is that it may narrow down too much how we define these things, and that may be a problem. And from our modern point of view, it is far more useful to go back to the shorter list and to understand the kind of general idea, so we can apply it afresh in our society rather than rely on details and on games and cosmetics and things that were found 2,000 years ago and that no longer may be applicable in our modern society. So this is all interesting. Again, it doesn't make hardly any difference at all as far as the overall meaning is concerned, but it is useful to be aware of these things, especially if you study the suttas quite a bit, as I like to do, because it opens up your eyes to potential flaws occasionally. In my experience, the suttas, if you read them, you don't have to worry too much about this because it makes very little difference. Still, occasionally it may actually matter, and that's why it's useful to know. So let's read out this middle section on ethics in a little bit more detail, and just to see if there's anything to comment on here. But I'm going to do this quite fast because it is not all that important, as I pointed out. What I read out before, there are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in injuring plants and seeds. So here, the idea of ascetics and Brahmins, these are the religious people at the time of the Buddha, and these religious people, they very often lived on the alms and the gifts of others, yeah? And because of that, you have an obligation to live in a certain way. You have to uphold your side of the bargain if other people support you. And your side of the bargain is to live like a proper ascetic or monastic. So you are given food, and then you should not be injuring plants and seeds. You should not be doing all of these other things that are listed here. That is your end of the bargain. What are we supposed to do as monastics? And our end of the bargain is to practice the path properly, yeah, to try to fulfill the path, to practice the morality the Buddha laid down, the Patimokkha rules and all the other obligations in the Vinaya Pitaka, the monastic law, if you like. And also, on top of that, ideally practice the path further by doing meditation practice, hopefully also ultimately getting some insight into these teachings. That is really our obligations as monastics. On top of that, if a monastic feels that they want to, we also encourage monastics to do some teachings. So if there's any way to paying back, it is usually by way of giving teachings. Yeah, that is the main way that you kind of pay back your debt, if you like, as a monastic. So those are the two ways. But any other way of livelihood, or anything which deviates from that, making a livelihood in a different way or breaking those precepts, that is when you don't uphold your end of the bargain as a monastic. And then that is why it is criticized here. Yeah, this is what this really is about. And then you have these various ways that you injure, yeah, plants and seeds. Plants propagated from roots, stems, cuttings, and joints. So it's all about just various types of plants and seeds, really. And so that is what that is about. And the ascetic Gotama refrains from such injury. And then other people, they praise him for that. Yay! The Master Gotama, he does not injure plants and seed. Yay, he is the best, he is supreme. And the Buddha says, well, maybe not. Maybe that isn't the most important thing. Maybe there are things that are more important than that. This is kind of the point here. Okay, and then we have the next one. So again, there are some ascetics and Brahmins, while enjoying the food given in faith, still engaged in storing up goods for their own use. For example, food, drink, clothes, vehicles, bedding, fragrances, and material possessions. But the Master Gotama refrains from storing up such goods. Thus, such is an ordinary person's praise of the realized one. So, this is a nice thing as a monastic. You try not to store things up. And one of the great things of being a monastic when you live in a monastery like Bodhinyana, even though you have a nice kuti, yeah, a nice hut where you can, which is, you know, you find kind of refuge from the elements outside, and you can, you know, it's nice for meditation practice, and you have maybe a few books to read the suttas, that kind of thing. Nothing which is there is actually yours, apart from some very simple things like your robe and bowl and maybe a few other things that you own. But the kuti and the whatever furnishings you have there and whatever bedding you have normally does not belong to the individual monks, yeah? So what that means is that if you want to leave the monastery, usually very simple. You can just take your things out, and if you have a bit too much, you can maybe give it away. But, you know, ideally, you just take everything, put it in your shoulder bag, and then you can walk out of the monastery, and that's it. And sometimes you see monks doing that, and it looks pretty impressive, yeah? Because you just walk out the gate, and then you've got all your possessions with you, hanging from your shoulder. And it gives a great sense of liberty and freedom when you can do that. So, again, this is about the idea of renunciation. And one of the qualities of the arahant is that he or she is incapable of storing things up in this way. That's what it says about the arahant, that they are incapable to do what the householder does of storing things up. In other words, of having ownership of a house and having ownership of all the things that belong in a house. They have given up that ownership. They don't feel that ownership anymore. They can't store things up. And presumably because the arahant, there is no fear about the future. There's no fear that you will need these things. And so you let it all go. There's no attachments at all anymore. Let it all go. Yay! And then you feel really light and things as a consequence. So these are, on the one hand, these are issues of morality, but they are also, interestingly, if you look at it deeply, they are also expressions of awakening in a very deep sense. This is how these awakened beings actually live. They are really moral. They really have renounced things. The next one. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in seeing shows. This includes such things as dancing, singing, music, performances, or storytelling. Clapping, gongs and kettle drums, art exhibitions and acrobatic displays, battles of elephants, horses, buffaloes, bulls, goats, rams, chickens and quails, staff fights, boxing and wrestling, combat, roll calls of the armed forces, battle formations and regimental reviews. The ascetic Gotama refrains from such shows. Such is an ordinary person's praise of the realized one. So, in other words, they try to make it very clear that all shows are considered no good if you are a monastic. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in gambling that causes negligence. So these are like games, yeah? It's not entirely clear that it is gambling, but it certainly is about games. So you have, this is Ajahn Sujata's translation, this includes such things as checkers and draughts, checkers in the air. So these are like board games, yeah? The Attapada and Dasapada is the Pali. It literally means something like, with eight padas, like pada is like a foot or square or rows or something like that. So it's like games with eight rows or ten rows or something like that. Checkers in the air, hopscotch, spillikins, board games, tipcat, drawing straws, dice, leaf flutes, toy plows, somersaults, pinwheels, okay. Toy measures, toy carts, toy bows, bows, and guessing words from syllables and guessing another's thoughts. The ascetic Gotama refrains from such games and gambling. Such is an ordinary person's praise of the exalted one. Okay. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still make use of high and luxurious bedding. This includes such things as sofas, couches, woolen covers, shag-piled, colorful, white, embroidered with flowers, quilted, embroidered with animals, double or single fringed. These are different kind of covers. And silk covers studded with gems. Okay, you hear that, Venerable? You can't have a silk cover studded with gems. Yeah? Can you can you deal with that? So that's pretty obvious, I think, that you shouldn't have a silk cover studded with gems. I don't know who would have that anyway, except maybe if you are super duper wealthy. It sounds a bit unusual. Anyway, as well as silken sheets, woven carpets, rugs for elephants, horses and chariots, antelope hide rugs, and spreads of fine deer hide, with a canopy above and red cushions at both ends. And they said the Gotama refrains from such bedding. Such is an ordinary person's praise of the realized one. And in this case, you can really see the limitations of such kind of commentary, because this is very specific, and you could probably very easily find modern versions of luxurious bedding that wouldn't be covered by this. And so for that reason, it's actually better just to go back to the basic definition, high and luxurious bedding. Yeah, and then it becomes fairly obvious, if you are wise, what is allowable and what is not. So not to get too stuck in the details there. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in beautifying and adorning themselves with garlands, fragrances, and makeup. This includes such things as applying beauty products by anointing, massaging, bathing, and rubbing, mirrors, ointments, garlands, fragrances, and makeup, face powder, foundation, bracelet, headbands, fancy walking sticks or containers, rapiers, parasols, fancy sandals, turbans, jewelry, chowries, and long-fringed white robes. Okay. The Sati Gautama refrains from such beautification and adornments. Such is the an ordinary person's praise of the realized one. Okay, so again, very detailed there, but probably the shorter version is plenty enough to understand what you're supposed to, not supposed to do. No. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in unworthy talk. This includes such topics as talk about kings, bandits, and ministers, talk about armies, threats, and wars, talk about food, drink, clothes, and beds, talk about garlands and fragrances, talk about family, vehicles, villages, towns, and cities, and countries, talk about women and heroes, street talk and well talk, talk about the departed, motley talk, talk of land and sea, and talk about being reborn in this or that state of existence. The Ascetic Gautama refrains from such unworthy talk. Such is an ordinary person's praise of the realized one. So this is a standard passage that you see many places in the suttas, or the Vinaya as well, about the talk you're supposed to avoid. And this kind of talk is really very closely related to the fourth kind of wrong speech, of avoiding kind of idle chatter and nonsense talk. So this is like the sampapalapa veramani, the avoidance of sampapalapa, which almost sounds like idle chatter in its own right. Sampapalapa. Sampa, palapa. Palapa is like talk, and sampa is like a useless talk. Yeah, and interesting, when I went to Indonesia last time, I think, I there was a garbage or a rubbish bucket there, yeah, where you throw your rubbish. I asked where, you know, I came, for some reason we came across this word, and then they started laughing, because to them, their word for rubbish bucket is sampa. Yeah, exactly the same word you have here. So rubbish talk, yeah, it fits really well. And of course, the Indonesian language is very heavily, quite heavily influenced by Sanskrit. They have a lot of Sanskrit words in Indonesian language. So that quite clearly is a word that comes from Sanskrit, and they use it now for the rubbish buckets, whereas in the suttas it is used for rubbish speech, yeah, or idle chatter, if you like, or useless speech, or nonsense, or whatever. Anyway, that's kind of interesting to see this historical connection sometimes. So that is the bad speech, yeah, so that kind of relates to the bad speech that we were talking about before. Then there are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in arguments. This is another bad kind of speech, yeah, this is a kind of harsh speech or something like that. And they say such things as, you don't understand this teaching and training, I understand this teaching and training. What you understand this teaching and training? You're practicing wrong, I'm practicing right. I stay on topic, you don't. You said last what you should have said first. You said first what you should have said last. What you thought so much about has been disproved. Your doctrine is refuted. Go on, save your doctrine. You are trapped. Get yourself out of this, if you can. The Ascetic Gautama refrains from such argumentative talk. Such is an ordinary person's praise of the realized one. So they were pretty, in those days, they didn't mess around when it came to debate. They really kind of gave it to each other. You basically saying, pretty much sounds like you're saying, you idiot. That's what it sounds like here. You... And of course, the idea is that is avoided by the Buddha. Again, a standard passage found in many places in the suttas on the kind of speech to be avoided. If you're going to give talk and if you're going to have a discussion, then you should do so in a kind of balanced way and discuss things properly rather than getting argumentative and say silly things. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in running errands and messages. This includes running errands for rulers, ministers, aristocrats, Brahmins, householders, or princes who say, "Go here, go there, take this, bring that from there." The ascetic Gotama refrains from such errands. Such is an ordinary person's praise of the realized one. It's a bit like you are a bit kind of aloof or a bit sort of separated from ordinary society. You don't take part in ordinary society usually. And this, I guess, is maybe also a little bit a part of the kind of, maybe it's a kind of dignity as well, dignity of being a monastic. You don't kind of go around doing all kind of random errands for people. You kind of try to stay a little bit above that, I suppose, in a certain way, because it's not really part of your practice, especially if it is done as a livelihood and you get something in return for that. This doesn't mean that we never do anything like this. It would really depend on the situation. For example, if it was something for Buddhism, or it was between a monastic or a layperson or whatever, then, of course, it is slightly different, because you're not really just running random errands. You're doing something to help a fellow monastic or to help the Buddhist cause or whatever. It's a slightly different situation. So this is things that you would try to find that right balance on this. But generally speaking, that would be considered wrong livelihood. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in deceit, flattery, hinting and belittling, and using material possessions to pursue other material possessions. The ascetic Gotama refrains from such deceit and flattery. Such is an ordinary person's praise of the realized one. So again, you don't have this kind of idea of wrong livelihood, of getting things through wrong means. So that is the middle section. Now comes the long section, and the long section is even more details about various things. The wrong section is mostly about wrong livelihood. So it concerns things that a monastic might do to gain benefits out of other people. So this is kind of almost like helping people in a certain way or doing services for them and then getting something out of that, maybe food or support or whatever it is. And that is not appropriate for a monastic. So let me read that out fairly quickly, because it's not something we need to spend a lot of time on. But just again, remember that the right livelihood for a monastic is their practice, and then having the bowl, and then people offering you support, simply because you are practicing well, or because you are also giving teachings. Anyway, this is how it goes. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still earn a living by unworthy branches of knowledge, by wrong livelihood. Unworthy, this is the tirachana vijja, is what it's translated as unworthy. And tirachana, it usually means like an animal. It's almost like animal knowledge, or knowledge that is kind of horizontal to the world. In other words, it goes horizontal to the spiritual path. It has no relation to the spiritual path. It's like perpendicular to it. Doesn't make you rise or get high. It just kind of keeps you flat on the same level. This is one of the understandings of this tirachana gata, tirachana, crosswise. So, and this is an example of this. This includes such fields, fields of knowledge or fields of practice, or whatever you want to call it, such as limb reading, omenology, divining celestial portents, interpreting dreams, divining bodily marks, divining holes in cloth gnawed by mice, fire offerings, ladle offerings, offerings of husks, rice powder, rice, ghee or oil, offerings from the mouth, blood sacrifices, palmistry, geomancy for building sites. So geomancy, that's basically feng shui, yeah, which is very much a very much part of the Chinese culture. Fields and cemetery, exorcisms, earth magic, snake charming, poisons, the crafts of scorpions, the rat, the bird, the crow, prophesying lifespan, chanting for protection, and animal cries. So that is the a long list, yeah? And so all of these things are basically helping people out through kind of semi-magical ideas. Very interesting that the last one there is kind of chanting for protection. Sara parittanang. Paritta is a protection. Sara is an intonation, yeah? an intoned chanting for protection. You wonder to what extent we are fulfilling that particular part in vast parts of the Buddhist world. It seems to be something that we do quite a lot. Gee, I wonder, what do you think, Venerable, chanting for protection? It's okay, so that's it. Very interesting anyway. So some of these things, maybe we can do these things in a slightly different way or something. That seems to be something that happens quite a lot actually in the Buddhist world, chanting for protection, part of us, and it seems to go against this. But again, this is more of a commentarial nature, but it does seem to be reasonable. Anyway, I'll just move on fairly quickly. The ascetic Gautama refrains from such unworthy branches and others, such wrong livelihood. Such is an ordinary person's praise of the realized one. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still earn a living by unworthy branches of knowledge, by wrong livelihood. This includes reading marks on gems, cloth, clubs, swords, spears, arrows, weapons, women, men, boys, girls, male and female bondservants or slaves, elephants, horses, buffaloes, bulls, cows, goats, rams, chickens, quails, monitor lizards, rabbits, tortoises, or deer. So again, this reading of marks, yeah, it's like omens and prophesying really what this is all about, this thing here. Yeah. The ascetic Gautama refrains from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood. Such is an ordinary person's praise of the realized one. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who while enjoying food again, engage in wrong livelihood. This includes making predictions that the king will march forth or march back, or that our king will attack and the enemy king will retreat, or vice versa. Or that our king will triumph and the enemy king will be defeated, or vice versa. And so there will be victory for one and defeat for the other. The ascetic Gautama refrains from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood. Such is an ordinary person's praise of the realized one. And then the next group here of unworthy of wrong livelihood is making predictions that there will be an eclipse of the moon or the sun or the stars, that the sun, moon and stars will be in conjunction or in opposition, that there will be a meteor shower, a fiery sky, an earthquake, thunder, that there will be a rising, setting, a darkening, a brightening of the moon, the sun or the stars. And it also including making predictions about the results of all such phenomena. This again is a wrong livelihood, and although some people praise the Buddha for this, then it is not a big deal according to the Buddha. The next group, this predicting whether there will be plenty of rain or drought, plenty to eat or famine, an abundant harvest or a bad harvest, security or peril, sickness or health. And it also includes such occupations as computing, accounting, calculating, poetry and cosmology. Okay, the ascetic Gautama refrains from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood, such as an ordinary person's praise of the realized one. So here you have, not just do you have all these idea of predicting the future, which people often want, but here you also have fairly ordinary occupations, yeah, like accounting and making poetry and cosmology. These are kind of usual occupations, but of course that too is wrong livelihood for a Buddhist monastic. Yeah. So not just and making predictions and trying to read the future and being like like some kind of a shaman or whatever, but actually also avoiding any kind of ordinary livelihood. And we have the next group of bad livelihood, yeah? And this is making arrangements for giving or taking in marriage, for engagement and divorce, for scattering rice inwards or outwards at the wedding ceremony. It also includes casting spells for good or bad luck, curses to prevent conception, bind the tongue or lock the jaws. It could come in handy if someone talks too much. You can kind of lock the jaws with a spell. You know how to do that? I wonder how you do the spells. Maybe there's some kind of subcomment that gives you information on how these things are supposed to be done. I think we need some further research on this. I think you're right. No, I'm being naughty. So forget about that. I'm just messing around because that's what we like to do. We are Ajahn Brahm disciples. We like to kind of mess around a little bit, at least. Anyway, so charms for the hands and ears, questioning a mirror. Okay, a girl or a god as an oracle, worshipping the sun, worshipping the great one, Mahata Upatanang. Mahata, maybe that's the earth or something. I wonder what that means. The great one, Mahat. Could be the earth, maybe, I'm not sure. Breathing fire, invoking Siri, the goddess of luck. This is super duper detailed. So you kind of get the idea that all of these things are bad. Lucks and omens and charms and all this kind of stuff. And then we have the last set. And this last set is as follows. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still earn a living by unworthy branches of knowledge, by wrong livelihood. This includes rites for propitiation, for granting wishes, for ghosts, for the earth, for rain, for property settlement, and for preparing and consecrating house sites, and rites involving rinsing and bathing and oblations. It also includes administering emetics, purgatives, expectorants, and phlegmagogues. Phlegmagogues? Is that a word? Okay. I will take your word for that it is a word. Administering ear oils, eye restoratives, nasal medicines, ointments, and counter ointments. Surgery with needle and scalpel, treating children, prescribing root medicines, and binding on herbs. The ascetic Gautama refrains from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood. Such is an ordinary person's praise for the realized one. These are the trivial, insignificant details of mere ethics that an ordinary person speaks of when they speak praise of the realized one. So that is the end of the longer section on ethics. So you can see here great detail about how a monastic is not supposed to do all the things to be avoided. And yet all of these things are just mere details as far as the Buddha is concerned. So now we have set the groundwork. We have pointed out to all those things that are not fundamental to what it means to be a Buddha, but which other people praise him for. And now we are ready to look at the things that actually the Buddha really is worthy of praise. So hang in there, or don't hang in there, just maybe do something else in the meantime, but eventually we will come back to this, and then it will be exciting when we get to these actual things, these right views or whatever that of the Buddha, and all the wrong views that the Buddha does not hold. So it gets much more profound as we get into these things, and actually quite interesting in many, many ways, at least for some people who enjoy this kind of thing here. That is all for now. I can make no promise when I will get back to the next one. We'll just have to see. You have to watch out if you're interested, and then we'll see when the next session on this sutta will come. Okay, that is all for tonight. Is there any questions? Okay, we have a few questions, so we will take those. These are now all questions coming from outside of the hall, because there's no one here. Really, thank you very much. So we have two questions. And, okay, so this is interesting. This is from Shu in New York, the USA. And the question is, I work at the front line of the pandemic. This is really cool. Yeah, we get really up to scratch questions here about what is really happening in the world. So thank you very much for asking this kind of question. I don't have the option to quit. I hope I won't die. But if I do, I'm still a beginner. How do I get a good rebirth to continue the practice? Okay, well, you know, it is a wonderful opportunity to be at the front line of the pandemic. One of the things that we have been saying here at the Buddha Society of Western Australia and at Bodhinyana Monastery is that instead of being the coronavirus, it is the Karuna virus. Yeah, so if you use the coronavirus wisely, think about it in the right way, it becomes compassion. And the Pali word for compassion is Karuna, almost like Corona, Karuna. So we can make it into a Karuna virus instead. And we spread that Karuna like a virus out in society. Yeah? And then it becomes really powerful and useful. So remember, being at the front line, you have a great opportunity to develop this Karuna for the world and for people. There's so much suffering right now. So many people being in fear and anxiety over these things. Yeah, and you can see how vulnerable we are as people in the world, how incredibly unsafe and uncertain everything is. And before you know it, these massive problems kind of come into our societies and turn our lives upside down. Yeah, everything is so fragile, everything is so uncertain, everything is so vulnerable. And then you start to understand the compassion that we should really have at all times for people, because that underlying vulnerability is always there. But we only remember it when you get these kind of pandemics that we're getting now. So see it as a massive opportunity for, you know, for helping out, for being kind, for having compassion. Protect yourself to the best of your ability, yeah? Don't quit, because if you quit, you are missing out on this good opportunity. I don't know how old you are, but if you're not terribly old, it means that the chances of surviving this is very high. Yeah, there's only a tiny percentage of people who actually die from this. I think I read somewhere that people under 50, if you have no underlying conditions, medical conditions, your chances of dying is way under 1%. Yeah, so basically it is very, very small. And then once you had it, then presumably you will no longer get it again, because then you will have that resistance built into you for the future. So see it as an opportunity. So even if you are not on the front line, chances are you will get this coronavirus eventually, because it seems to be very infectious and just spreading around very, very fast. And that is your attitude, if you live like that, then that is exactly how you get the good rebirth. Yeah, that is exactly how you do it. Because when you practice in this way with a good heart and you take that opportunity, then when you die, you will feel good about yourself. You will feel happy about how you have lived your life. And then you die with a peaceful mind, feeling a sense of inward contentment and warmth and gratitude, maybe even that the world gave you this opportunity to be helping out in difficult times. As you do that, there won't be any big problem. So just live well, do the right thing. Continue with a little bit of meditation practice. Yeah, when you have to just calm yourself down and gain a bit of clarity in your ordinary life, and remember that when you go out, do it with compassion and kindness, and then you are creating all the right conditions for future good rebirth. And also remember the feeling you have now. Yeah, remember what it feels like, that sense of anxiety and fear about a difficult situation. And when this pandemic eventually passes, remember that feeling. Yeah, because that feeling, that underlying feeling of fear and anxiety, it will eventually come back again in new forms. And if we remember that at all times, it means we can live with greater sense of urgency about the path, because we understand that these underlying problems are always there, always waiting to be destructive and to kind of make life more difficult for us. We tend to forget about it, and only when these things happen are we reminded of the reality of life. So keep this in mind, yeah, when someone dies who is close to you, or, you know, whatever it is, that is the opportunity to remember the reality of existence and not sticking our head in the sand, which is really what happens with all the vast majority of people in this world. So good luck, and it's wonderful to hear from someone on the front line. I understand that New York is quite heavily affected by the pandemic, one of the worst places in the U.S. And so it is a wonderful opportunity to help out while trying to keep that balance and not getting too concerned about it. If you live well, there's nothing too much to be concerned about. Okay, next one is from C in Melbourne. I am distressed about what's happening now with the pandemic. Everyone is talking about COVID-19 and is anxious. Government is encouraging social distancing, which means no human contact. Human beings are social animals. How can I cope with this? Can you advise? We will still be doing live streamings here at the Buddha Society, yeah? And we have to have more contact by voice rather than by physical contact. And then what that means is that we try to be kind in how we speak to each other. This is a great opportunity to remember the uncertainty of life and say all of those things that you have wanted to say to people earlier, yeah? Things that you know you should really say. Your appreciation of some people in your life, very often we put these things off because we find it awkward to express our appreciation of other people. But now is your chance to do that. And then you create a different kind of bond that is not related to direct physical contact, but are related to more how we just think about each other. And we can care for each other in many different ways. And speech can be very powerful. Good speech is a very powerful gift to other people. Yeah, it can be very, when you hear good speech, people talking kindly, it really goes to your heart in a deep way. You feel peaceful, relaxed, and all of these kind of things. So speech is a very powerful tool. Don't underestimate that. Use that speech at a difficult time from this. And again, the problem here, you remember that all of these things, the kind of Ajahn Brahm's teaching that this too will pass and good, bad, who knows. A lot of goodness can come out of this kind of crisis and pandemic. People becoming more caring and kind to each other. If that is what happens, it's a wonderful thing because we need more kindness and care in this world. We need people looking out for each other, helping each other. This is maybe a chance to help elderly people with getting supplies of whatever whatever kind that they need. We are starting a group apparently here at the BSWA to help the elderly members of the Buddha Society with shopping and that kind of stuff, because they should really remain home because of the danger for the more elderly people of this COVID situation. So it is an opportunity to do so much good and to have compassion, to see how the world is suffering and how easy it is to fall into that suffering, and how it is always underlying our existence, waiting to come out at any time and rearing its ugly head and saying life is much more difficult than sometimes we think it is. So it is a wonderful opportunity to learn something about Dhamma, about practice, and how to live with kindness. And when you remember that the world is problematic in this way, that this is the underlying condition, it starts to shift your values. It starts to shift what is really important to you. It shifts your priorities, and you start to embrace the spiritual life much more, because you start to realize that it is our inner qualities is the only place where we have some control. You can control whether you want to be kind or not. You can control to some extent how you think about the world, how you think about others. And that is where we have some degree of influence on our lives. But the external world is terribly problematic. Remember that. This is a sign. Yeah? This is kind of what they call a deva duta in the suttas. Deva is the heavenly heaven, and duta is a messenger. It's a messenger from the gods, a messenger from the world to remind you of what really is valuable, what really matters in life, where we should really focus, so we can start to prioritize those things that really are important. So don't think it is as bad as it seems. Yeah, Ajahn Brahm's story, good, bad, who knows? Is it really bad? Perhaps it's good. Perhaps there are opportunities in this crisis that we don't really normally understand. Yes, there is a downside. Yes, we have to suffer. But in the long run, will it lead to something positive? Well, try to ensure that you learn something from this. Chances are very high that you will come through this unscathed. Yeah, there will be problems, no doubt, with some people dying, etc. But the vast majority of people will survive, and there won't be a problem. It will be bad for the economy, no doubt, and many people will probably lose some money and all of that. And again, it just reminds you that there is something deeper, more valuable in life than all of these external things. So this is how I would recommend you to use it as an opportunity for growth. In every problem in the world, every time there is dukkha and suffering here, there's a vast opportunity for growing, for changing, for looking at the world in a new way here. And that is where kind of the positive outcome of this. Make the best of a difficult situation here. Then hopefully something positive will come from this. Good luck, because it is not easy, but with wisdom and appropriate way of thinking, you will have something positive coming out of it. Okay, that is all for today. So we will be back again next week, and at the very latest.